Today, get ready to start your engines, fire up your flux capacitors, because we are going back to the 80s. The 80s was a great time of tremendous growth, expansion, and opportunity. New initiatives for business and creative were launched. Many continue to impact the current marketplace. Today's companies are using the plans, the blueprints, the playbooks from the 80s, and we are examining it all in our new series, The 880s Events That Shaped the 2000s, starting today on an all-new episode of Robservations. Hey, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Robservations. I am your host, Rob Liefeld. We here at Robservations are obsessed with comic books and superheroes and all things comic books and superheroes across all media platforms. The show that you're streaming, the big budget movie you just got out of seeing, the toys that you're buying on the aisles of all the big box stores, the downloadable video games, the video games on all of the different platforms, the PlayStation games, the Xbox. However you are experiencing these comic book superheroes, this show is here to give you a deep dive and to take you in-depth behind the scenes of the great sagas and events that shaped the comic book industry, as well as the kick-ass creators who created and made all these great stories and characters for you to fall in love with on the big screen and on the streaming and on the cartoons in the first place. I have been doing comic books for just shy of 40 years. It has been my absolute passion and pleasure. It is the love of my life, making comic books, creating worlds, scenarios, conflicts, consequences. And I have been inspired by some of the true greats in the medium and was fortunate enough to have broken into comic books and the comic book scene in 1986, where I was able to make friends with so many of the legends that inspired me as a kid. My earliest memories of comic books are going back and pulling them off the spinner racks in 1974. So I have been experiencing, consuming, in love with comics for 50 years running. 50 long years. And this love affair shows no signs of slowing down anytime soon. As a matter of fact, I revisit those 1974 comics often because it was a seminal year in comic books. Who knew that at 7 years old, buying these comics, I would be part of history? It is the year that Wolverine debuted in the pages of The Incredible Hulk. When Wolverine splashed onto the scene, kids like me, we dug him. I was like, who's this new character, Wolverine? And Wendigo, and he's in the middle of this giant conflict with these giant titans fighting it out in the Canadian tundra, and he's some sort of Canadian super agent, Weapon X. It was incredible. It was so fun. At the time, I was completely engulfed by the Fantastic Four, which I had been introduced to a few months earlier, right at the dawn of 1974. I've gone over at my barber shop, had 147 on his stack of superhero comics, featured Namor, the Prince Namor, the Submariner, bursting up out of the ocean to battle the Thing, rocked my world. I traded some Richie Rich and Casper the Friendly Ghost, and I was it. My big ticket to the Marvel Universe had been punched. In 1974, there was a movie released called The Golden Voyage of Sinbad. The Sinbad movies, a particular flex for the incredible Ray Harryhausen, who was a master puppeteer and one of the chief special effects gurus before Lucasfilm and ILM would hit the scene and just blow everything up. So before George Lucas, and even early on, George Lucas was looking to imitate and did in fact initiate some Ray Harryhausen style effects in the original 1977 Star Wars. But that Golden Voyage of Sinbad, the commercials were constant, and as a seven-year-old kid, it was one of the earliest live-action movies that I saw. The first live-action movie that I can remember, the first movie that I can remember seeing with my dad at a theater, because he would often just take me and him to drive-thrus. They were a huge thing. The drive-thru theater was a staple of my 70s childhood. And I saw the, I think it was a reissue of the Disney Robin Hood, where Robin Hood is a fox cartoon, or maybe it was the first run. But I just, again, that was a result of me just responding to these incredible commercials and loving Robin Hood and loving this version of Robin Hood that Disney had imagined. And so my dad took me there. But the next time we were on a road trip, my dad and I went with him, I think, out to Palm Springs. And we went out to a drive-thru and we saw The Golden Voyage of Sinbad. And it is one of my, to this day, I own it. I got the DVD about 20 some years back. And I give it a rewatch about every year, and it was just, I loved that version, that version of this particular fantasy world, and Sinbad and his crew, and all the different beasts and monsters that they encountered. Marvel had done an adaptation in 1974, and I remember seeing that and being able to negotiate. You know, but we saw the movie. Can I have the comic? Because my parents had a long-standing kind of back and forth against being against comic books. But Hulk battled, had great battles with Adam Warlock, who I think probably could have stood to be given better servicing by the third Guardians of the Galaxy movie. I know we were all the fans of Adam Warlock from the 70s on. We were looking forward to him, his portrayal in Guardians of the Galaxy. Wasn't quite satisfied. I know he was part of the final kind of the after credits or the end of the movie, jumping into action with what was the new Guardians. But the Adam Warlock of my childhood was such a prominent figure and such an incredible character. And we all rallied around him and bought all of his appearances. And then eventually he got his own showcase. So 1974 is very rich in my mind. The Fantastic Four and the Hulk and Wolverine and scattered issues of the Avengers. I wouldn't dive completely into being a monthly subscriber, monthly consumer of the Avengers comic until I was about 8. But all this stuff is very, very vivid to me. The 70s are extremely important to me. But the 80s have some great high points. And for me, the 80s era is, whether I like it or not, because I don't like 80s comics as much as I like this stretch in the 70s from about 74 to 1980, to me is golden. And it is because of the quality of talent that was peaking at that time. Jim Starlin, George Perez, John Byrne, Marv Wolfman, Chris Claremont, Terry Austin. These people were absolutely, Dave Cockrum, I can't leave out the incredible Dave Cockrum, and so many others were just thrilling me. And the art form was in such a great place. John Buscema, Sal Buscema. By the mid 80s, I've been very vocal that I had begun to lose my luster. And in fact, it was probably the time in the mid 80s, middle high school for me, that I was starting to lose the magic of comic books. It was the most in danger that I had ever gotten to falling out of love with comics. I just did not like where Marvel Comics particularly was at in the middle of that decade. Much of the talent that I loved, Frank Miller, how did I not mention Frank Miller during this incredible period? Frank Miller, John Byrne, George Perez, the big names that I loved, Jim Starlin, had all gone to DC Comics. And I followed them there as a consumer. With my dollars, I started buying more DC Comics. And certainly my Marvel Comics budget decreased. My interest in titles like the Fantastic Four and the Avengers waned. The X-Men, to me, had its least engaging creative period. I've covered so much of this in the first couple of years of my podcast, because here on Rob Observations, I started you on this journey with me picking these comic books off the spinner rack. I had a rich network of comic book distribution in my immediate neighborhood, just three blocks up. I go back there once a year. I drive by the four quadrant, all four corners in some way or another were informative to my comic book experience. The cross streets of Broadway and Magnolia in Anaheim. There was a 7-Eleven across the street from the liquor store. The liquor store is now the 7-Eleven. The 7-Eleven jumped in the 80s over and took over the liquor store when it went out of business. Now there's a Mexican restaurant where the 7-Eleven used to be. And then the grocery store, which was called a Stater Brothers grocery store. There are many Stater Brothers all over Southern California still. But it, in the, again, beginning of the 80s, Stater Brothers went out of business and it was replaced by a 24-hour health and fitness, a gym. So when I go back there, I relive those memories, but at least there is a 7-Eleven there. No, they are no longer, distributing comics. They don't have a spinner rack. All of those kind of left sometime in the mid-90s. But the 80s, as much as I was falling out of love with comics, it was in a period of incredible advancement. many of you, the listeners, really, the 80s is your sweet spot. I have learned this. I am part of enough many groups on social media that entertain all these different notions. I will fight for the 80s up till about 1983. Maybe I'll stretch it to 85, but then there's like a, for Marvel at least, the 1983 to 86, 87 period to me is very forgettable. But the 80s was an incredibly impactful period. And this episode that you're listening to is the eight 80s events that shaped the 2000s. And we are going to, through this series, go through the different really seminal events, decisions that have shaped comic books of today. Comic books of the early millennium. There was a playbook established, and they turned to it. The 90s really was a period that was, it is not, you can't replicate it. You can't duplicate it because it was kind of chaos. It was absolute chaos. We detailed in a recent series the nine controversies that shook the 90s. We walked you through all of those different moments of chaos. Just random events and situations that turned comic books on its ear. The industry upside down flipped it sometimes. But the 80s was a time of expanse. It was a time of experimentation because the what they call the direct comic book market, and that is what people in the business call it, the direct comic book market, was being established. And through that, the marketing teams at both Marvel and DC, and then all of these other independent companies that cropped up, First Comics, Kamiko, Pacific Comics. Some of these comic companies are long gone, okay? Dark Horse is the strongest relic in regards to being as old as it is and surviving and thriving. But there was a time when First Comics and a comic book company called Kamiko and a comic book company called Eclipse and a comic book company called Pacific, they were absolute pioneers. They were what people thought Image Comics was going to be, a fly-by-night kind of run aground after less than a decade, not even you know, establish themselves. And here Image Comics is 30-plus years later, blasting through the industry, still a trailblazer. But Image Comics wouldn't be what it was without all the lessons that we learned as kids, because we were all kids, maybe some of us not so much. I saw the other day that some of my former Image founders and former partners have had birthdays, and I'm like, wow, that guy is 7 years older than me. I thought he was four. Like even I'm like realizing, wow, I was again the youngest of the bunch. So when maybe they weren't teenagers like I was, but the 80s is a very, very important period in the world of comic books and the world of pop culture. Certainly, it was in the world of pop culture, and as much as I love 80s movies and 80s music, I think that the comic books of the 80s, there were definitely some standouts, but more than anything, there were key moments, events, happenings, and business decisions that became the de facto playbook for everything in the 2000s. And that is what we are going to discuss. This is not going to be a continual series. I will be dropping back intermittently over the course of the next month or so, giving you episodes of these eight 80s events that shaped the 2000s, and we'll be parsing them as closely as we can. But that is the purpose of this show. The purpose of this show is to look at comics history and the people who made it. And as I said, I was so fortunate early in my career to get to know so many of the movers and shakers, to hang out and to spend, you know, hours upon hours with legends like Jack Kirby, legends like Stan Lee. Okay, have Gil Kane do this incredible story for us in a book that we did called Judgment Day, and call upon some of these incredible legends. Be George Perez's chauffeur. Have, you know, meaningful conversations with Dave Cockrum and Keith Giffen. Get to know Jim Starlin. Hang out with Jim Starlin for days on end at conventions and at Disneyland. It's, and at that point, I'm just a kid again, and I'm just picking their brains, and I'm just trying to get into their, you know, into their kind of purview and how they would, you know, view things in the past. Neil Adams, multiple dinners, multiple encounters where I would just glean as much of the wisdom of Neil Adams and his outlook on the comics industry over the years as I possibly could. And so I was just fortunate to be in this era and really truly learn from the greats. And so that is those perspectives and the being there aspect of buying these comics in the 70s and 80s, it is relevant to me. I could tell you what my top 10 favorite comics of 1974 were, like drop of the hat. It's so easy to me. Mostly they would be of the Fantastic Four and the Hulk variety, because those were the two books that impacted me the most, that I loved the most. I loved the Hulk's Rogues Gallery, the Abomination. I loved Doc Samson. I again the battles with Adam Warlock, the eventual arrival of Wendigo and Wolverine. I mean, all this stuff incredibly impactful to me. But then I grew and I became part of the comic book industry, and made moves as a creator and made moves as a businessman. So again, if this is one of your earliest encounters with my podcast, we just go as deep as we possibly can on so many of the events, because, you know, again, yesterday informs today. The past absolutely informs the present, and that is the thing that I love to discuss the most, and we are about to get it kicked off. Eight 80s events that shaped the 2000s is on. Among the most memorable to me of the kind of late 80s shaping of Marvel Comics, because Marvel Comics had successfully, again, I've documented this in a series. Probably the first three seasons are packed full. I walk you basically from 1974 all the way up to the 90s with the expansion of the X-Men and how that franchise became just runaway monster hit from them, and spinoffs and miniseries. And I mean, it became its own family. Again, just never forget, the X-Men was in reprints for over 3 years. They were just keeping the trademark alive. It came out bi-monthly, six times a year. That's it. They rebrand it, read about it, listen to it on my podcast. And it struggles even after the reboot and the kind of fan favorite status that the book had. It then got a new penciler and inker, a creative team that supercharged what was already there. And it went from bi-monthly to monthly, and it never looked back, and it climbed the charts, and it became a runaway monster, just a monster franchise that Marvel then spent the early part of the 80s kind of, you felt like, they were like, does anything with the X-Men sell? Yes. The answer was yes. Wolverine miniseries, boom, number one. Let's do a follow-up that with a not quite the same A-list tier team. Will that sell? Oh boy, that sold. Let's do an Iceman miniseries. Wow, that did better numbers than half the line. Let's do a Beast miniseries with Dazzler. Oh my gosh, that's pulling numbers. Let's spin off and do Young Kids at the Academy, New Mutants. Oh man, that's doing really good. That's rocking the charts. And then wait, should we give Wolverine his own title? Oh baby. Another number one launch, X-Factor, reuniting of the original five X-Men team that no one seemed to care about, which is why it went into reprints and needed the reboot with Colossus and Wolverine and Banshee and Sunfire and Nightcrawler and Storm. But X-Factor, again, so they were just growing this incredible family. But what about the original line of the Stan and Jack characters? This is kind of like a soft Heroes Reborn test run. And what they did, it became a house ad. A house ad is an ad in all the comic books promoting the in-house comic books. An in-house ad promoting the line of comics that the publisher wants you to read. So you bought an issue of X-Men, of course you got this ad. And it had Thor and Spider-Man and Iron Man and Captain America and Hulk. There, right there, is the strong nucleus of the earliest of the Stan and Jack stuff. Outside of the Fantastic Four, there you go. Spider-Man, Thor, Captain America, Hulk, Iron Man, except they all look different. Spider-Man is in his all-black costume that came out of the middle of the Secret Wars miniseries. And trust me, Event Horizons is part of the eight 80s events that shaped the 2000s. But this, and I discussed this, scratch the surface on this topic that I'm bringing up to you right now. Let's call our first entry into this the derivatives, okay? The derivatives. We're going deeper into and isolating, because in the years since I did, I think it's been about 3.5 years since I did my first, you know, I scratched the post with the initial attempt to discuss the derivatives, it has blown up. Look no further than the Spider-Verse to see how much. Now, you're like, Liefeld, they did the Spider-Verse in 2014, Copiel, Coipel, and Dan Slott. I'm aware. But it did not take the super nuclear boost that it did until the Spider-Verse films came out, and the second one seemed to just rip the lid off the Spider-Verse, and now that is like, put it on global blast. People who didn't know that there were umpteen iterations of Spider-Man now know. Well, again, for two decades, Spider-Man didn't have any other costume than that brilliant original design. And then one day he has a black costume with a giant white spider on it. The story behind that, a fan sent the design in. Jim Shooter paid that guy, bought that design from that fan. They then implemented it into the storyline of the Secret Wars. And when Spider-Man returns from this event called Secret Wars, in his regular book for the next couple of years, he wears, and in all of his appearances, whether it's in Marvel Team-Up or Spectacular Spider-Man or Amazing Spider-Man, he is dedicated to wearing this black costume with the white emblem, and fans dug it. I dug it. Raise your hand. You know you dug it. A lot of people dug it because it was cool. It was a cool looking kind of diversion from what we had already known, and it was fresh enough that like people dug it. It really took. I mean, again, we've talked so many times here. I mean, I just revisited this the other day. Here's the deal. The reason that I cite artists most, and if you're an artist and you're listening to this, you know what I'm about to say is the truth. Denis Villeneuve, the visionary director of Sicario and obviously the these brilliant new Dune movies that are taking him to the next level, he made a very controversial quote 3 weeks ago saying he goes to the movies for the visuals and not the dialogue and the excessive dialogue. And he says that streaming and networks like Netflix have ruined films because everybody, that they think everybody wants talky chatter. Now, of course, the legion of, Tarantino, and I love Tarantino dialogue as much as anybody. I love his banter. All of these great screenwriters who really are capable of just compelling you with these incredible conversations and narratives that they can construct. But I go to movies, and my memories of movies, and when I move the most is by the sweeping visuals that I see on the screen. And it was that way before IMAX was even a twinkle in somebody's eyes. It was that way with the original Star Wars films and whatever, movies that I was able and fortunate enough to see in the theaters. Raiders of the Lost Ark, Jaws, Close Encounters, lot of Spielberg movies for guys my age, my generation of film fanboys and fangirls. Visuals are a big deal. And so when I recall comic books, I think of the pictures first. I think of the pictures and I think of the artists. Sometimes I forget the writers because it's the visuals that move me. It's the visuals, okay, that shape my excitement. And Spider-Man in the black costume was a kick-ass visual. So immediately you're like, I may not want to like this, but I like this. And then in the hands of, let's say, a Rick Leonardi. He's an incredibly talented penciler that doesn't get enough blow in that era. He was kind of overshadowed somewhat by the arrival of Art Adams, who was just an ounce, maybe more blatantly pandering and commercial than he was. And I say pandering in the best possible way. Everybody who launched Image Comics was an absolute panderer. But people used to say that to us as like a put down. Oh, you guys pander. Like, yes, we do. Todd and I, we would high five. Panderers are us right here. We loved to pander. When we were pandered to, we responded. Thank you, John Byrne, Double Page Splashes, Jack Kirby, Double Page Splashes, George Perez, Double Page Splashes, Michael Golden, Big Giant Shots. We love pandering. I say pandering as a badge of honor. Do not, when I talk about pandering, that's a good thing. When I say that Art Adams was slightly more pandering and more commercial, those go hand in hand. They fit like a glove. Okay, that matters. Rick Leonardi, when he was drawing the black costume, damn, it looked hot. It looked good. You're like, I may be liking this more than the, wait, is that blasphemous, than the original costume? By the time they brought the original costume, it was time. Okay, it was time. But that black costume had its day. In this ad, which became the cover of Marvel Age 57, also, Thor was in new armor. He had not his traditional outfit, and under the penmanship, the guidance of Walt Simonson, who had already transformed the comic book and made it just a giant can't-miss monthly blockbuster. He implemented a giant, thick, blonde beard that Thor hadn't had at any time when I was collecting comics. When I first started grabbing comics in 1974, clean-shaven Thor, all the way up to this 1987 version where he gets a beard, okay? We talked about Wolverine got a gun, Batman got a gun, Cap got a gun, Thor got a beard, okay? Thor got a beard, and he got this more bulkier armor and chainmail, and, you know, it looked pretty good. I was willing, okay, all right. I remember in my sketchbook, did I do drawings of bearded Thor? I did. Because I feel like nobody pulled him off better than Walt. Walt didn't do him for a tremendous period of time. He then would it was around the time that he was leaving the book artistically. But you know, you saw at least on covers and some of the earliest incarnations of that look of Thor, Walt gave it to you. The Captain America is not even Captain America in the shots. He is wearing his black. Black is popular, right? Black worked for Spider-Man. So are we going to put black on Cap? We did. We put black on Cap, and we put a red, white, and you know, a red and black insignia, kind of red and black flag. And it is the beginnings of what you would know as the U.S. agent. And so many of you saw the U.S. agent or encountered him for the first time on Winter Soldier and Falcon. And as fans, we like the Winter. I'm going to tell you, the kids of the 80s, Captain America probably got the biggest facelift from this storyline. This is when Captain America started to be really good again. Under the authorship of Mark Gruenwald, Kieran Dwyer, Ron Lim. These were the people who were contributing at the time when they were portraying this pivot to the U.S. agent period where again, we've talked about it, the vigilante approach to the superhero. This Cap was a little meaner. He was a bit of a brawler. He was as reckless as the U.S. agent was portrayed by Wyatt Russell on the show. But on the show, man, people really had this terrible reaction to him. And I remember talking during while it was airing, talking about how much I loved it and getting brushed back. And I was actually, like, I don't even want to repeat some of the things that I was said just because I liked Wyatt Russell's portrayal. I mean, the U.S. agent was always an asshole. There was no question about the fact that he was kind of out of balance, kind of the bad boy version of Cap. She got Cap is in a black, white, and red costume now. The blue is gone. Okay? So we've got bearded Thor with heavy armor. I mean, armored legs, armored arms. I mean, he is armored up. You've got black costume Spider-Man. And then for the first time since I had been around enjoying Iron Man, same kind of scenario with Thor. Whereas for 12, 13 years, the only Iron Man that I was encountering was the gold and red armored Iron Man. Now he had different, he had a more triangular tips on his mask, more of an extended V shape on his faceplate. He had a nose at one point that they put on, but never had he not been gold, you know, gold and red. Suddenly he's white and red in this ad, and the design is slightly different. They made some design tweaks. Dare I say he was looking a little more, especially from the chest and shoulders, a little more like a Transformer. But he was white and red, so new armor for Iron Man, new costume for Spider-Man, new look and costume for Thor, new look, costume, and identity for Captain America in the books of Captain America. And then finally, they put Hulk all the way back to his earliest presentation, how we met the Hulk before a couple issues in, he became green forevermore. They are turning him gray. Now, if you came upon the Todd McFarlane issues of Hulk during that time, he was doing the Gray Hulk. So Gray Hulk had just kind of happened a few issues prior to Todd coming on board. Al Milgram had done some. John Byrne had left the book. We're going to get to that John Byrne Hulk run eventually because it is incredible what that accomplished in a very brief window. But what you've got is five of Marvel's biggest legendary icons. They weren't the top in the sales at the time, but it was this basically what comic book readers referred to as Marvel's period of New Coke. We've gone over the fact that Coke and Pepsi, and even the other day, you know, there's a big announcement that Subway, I mean, it made the Today Show, Good Morning America, it made CNN. Subway is opting out of its long partnership with Coca-Cola, and they're going to enter into a relationship with Pepsi and only offer Pepsi products. Now, where that matters to Rob Liefeld and really speaks to little Robbie Liefeld is Pepsi is the godfather, the manufacturer, the producer of Mountain Dew, and that's all that matters. All that matters is that there is now Mountain Dew in Subways. If I said Arby's, excuse me, Subways. So Subway is pivoting from Coke to Pepsi. That's a big deal. That's a giant chain that is swapping out. And of course, it harkened back, and they wanted to show you the history of the Cola Wars. Kids my age, and all of you, so many I hear from, remember the Pepsi Challenge, where they would have you, and this was all over the country. I walked by a Pepsi Challenge in my mall as a kid. I did not want to wait in the line and participate. But you were seated at a desk, and behind a curtain was the Pepsi and the bottle, and you could, the Pepsi can and the Coke can. They just gave you, because they're both, you know, brown liquids, they put the brown liquids in a cup in front of you. You tasted one, you tasted the other, and then you declared which one you favored. Pepsi would give you this, like, you know, 7 out of 10 people prefer Pepsi. And that was just an incredible marketing gimmick. This surge of Pepsi in the late 70s, early 80s caused Coke to change the formula of Coke, and they marketed new Coke. If you weren't around, this was a big flipping deal. Celebrity endorsements, huge ad buys in magazines, billboards, TV commercials, and people 1,000% hated it. People hated the taste of new Coke. Giant shipments of new Coke, the giant walls that these grocery stores built with these cans of cola were just rejected. People were like, we don't want it, and they demanded bring back classic Coke. In my mind, it was 6 months. Maybe it was longer. Maybe it was shorter. But Coke listened to the people, and they pulled the plug on New Coke immediately. The reason that fans refer to this era at Marvel as New Coke is because it really was just these brief pivots, because eventually everybody would return to form. Cap would return to his classics. Hulk would go back to being green. Thor, Iron Man were the quickest pivots, and Spider-Man. Hulk was probably changed the longest. But you knew, you just knew he was going back. But what this represents is derivatives. This is, let's take something that already exists, and rather than make something new, let's just put a new twist on, I hear Bronson Pinchot from Beverly Hills Cops, a new twist, I give a little twist. Let's give a little twist to the Marvel heroes, okay? Sorry, I saw, my kids do not share my passion for Eddie Murphy, and finally, I won them over this Christmas, this past Christmas, 2023, but with a screening of Beverly Hills Cop. I had tried to sway them with Coming to America and with Trading Places. I know you're like, really, Liefeld? We're going on an Eddie Murphy diatribe. Just allow me this, okay? Bronson Pinchot with a little... anyway, would you like a little twist? These were Marvel characters with a little twist, okay? And this, to me, opened the door for everything that's going on today, because it became a house ad. You saw this prominently displayed in all the Marvel comics, telling you that these characters were all going in brand new, bold directions. What, pray tell, caused Thor to grow out a beard? What's he covering? Why is he now wearing armor? What new manufactured armor is Iron Man wearing? Who is this person portraying himself as Captain America? Why is Spider-Man in a costume that, dun-dun-dun, is a living, breathing alien symbiote? There were stories to go with all of these things, and they took us on a certain ride, but it was just a little twist, and it wasn't a brand new character, and it was just a slight deviation, a derivative of something that already existed. And I gotta tell you, this was just scratching the surface for all that was about to come. Now before you are screaming back at me going, Liefeld, it what about She-Hulk and Captain Marvel and Spider-Woman? Yep. Those were also in the derivative category. Let's take a male identity and make it into a female identity. Now, Marvel is famously on the record as wanting to do that so as to stop a bionic woman type situation with the Hulk on the Incredible Hulk show that starred Bill Bixby as David Banner. Remember, they didn't call him Bruce. David Banner. They didn't want some CBS writer going, hey man, what if he gives a blood transfusion to his sister, his cousin, and she turns into the Hulk too? They anticipated that, and if that is the reason, that's great. It's been the reason that they lean into forever, especially now Spider-Man was becoming a cartoon property, and they made Spider-Woman, and she got her own cartoon on Saturday mornings that we don't talk about often enough, but I never missed it. I loved Spider-Woman. I loved the very first, the Jessica Drew Spider-Man was my jam. I never missed an issue. I thought, again, a great design. But yes, they had scratched the surface, but now we're going into full overload. These are not, in many instances, new identities, except for the U.S. agent. These are literally just a tweak of a costume, a change of an appearance, and you've got a new storyline. And again, within no time whatsoever, come the late 80s and early 90s, there is a female version of the Thing. And the Spider-Man derivatives just come out swinging. You already had Spider-Woman. You have the black costume Spider-Man. Now you've got Spider-Ham, Peter Porker. He is the only action figure that I bought celebrating the original Spider-Verse because I did not know that I could live in a world where I could have a Spider-Ham Peter Porker action figure. It is on my desk right next to Deadpool and Cable, my drawing table in my office opposite where I record this show. And I literally, many times a week, I pick him up. He looks great. It's a great action figure. Is that a derivative? It sure as hell is. Spider-Ham. The derivatives were full. It was full on go time. Now you can say, well, Frank Miller opened that door, giving us a female Robin. Well, sure, you wouldn't be wrong. That's also a switch on the Spider-Woman, the She-Hulk, and the Ms. Marvel that was happening in the 70s. And then you're like, no, Rob, let's go to Batgirl. Look, you can have Batgirl all you want. There are signposts as far back as Captain Marvel Jr., Mary Marvel, and Superboy and Supergirl, right? Okay, that exists. But this was the number one publisher, because Marvel was far and away the number one publisher during this period, and they were starting to lean into, well, just new looks, provide new books, and new stories, provide new glories, and they were off to the races. Cut to mid-90s, and you're getting 2099 futuristic versions of Spider-Man. Spider-Man 2099, Punisher 2099. I mean, they are leaning into now giving you various versions of these characters, multitudes eventually. I mean, then the 2000s kicks down the door. The new regime enters Marvel Comics, the new ownership, and they decide we are going to blow your minds with doing what they call the ultimate versions of these. Ultimate Spider-Man, we're going to retell the Spider stories as if they were brand new to you, starting back with him in high school, so we can restart this because there's a Tobey Maguire, Sam Raimi, Sony Spider-Man movie coming your way. We want to make sure that there's a comic book that people who walk out of that movie can access. There is a younger version of the X-Men, Ultimate X-Men. The Ultimates are coming. You're getting the ultimate version of Thor, Iron Man, Hawkeye, Captain America. Marvel leaned all the way into this playbook. Go all the way to today. Walk right up to Spider-Boy, launched last year. We have not looked back. Miles Morales in the middle of the Ultimate universe. I mean, the one we're getting the most of, and again, this is why eventually when we break the door down in that 2013-2014 era of the Spider-Verse storyline, and suddenly, you know, what I'm seeing the most of in the last few months is Spider-Punk, boom, signal boost, okay? All of the Spider-Verse, Spider-Gwen, Signal boost. And you're like, hey, Rob, yes, I'm aware. Guilty as charged. There's a Deadpool movie coming out. There are not just whispers, but we already have proof. They coughed up photos of Dogpool because I was on the road back from Vegas. My sons, our entire family, we would absolutely love driving to Vegas, not for a comic book convention, but we would love going to the boys' AAU tournaments, and several times a year we would go to Vegas and have a weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, of just nonstop tournaments. I mean, my kids were playing against John Stockton's kids, Dennis Rodman's kids. I mean, this was an exciting time. I mean, I, as a lifelong NBA crazy head, going, oh my gosh, you know, Chase Liefeld is just scored on Dennis Rodman's kid, and there's Dennis Rodman and his and the kid's mom right there, and John Stockton is getting up screaming at Luke Liefeld's coach as they go head to head. My son's Chase's coach was a former Houston Rocket. It was, you know, you would go to these games and there's James Worthy walking in. Oh, there's Michael Cooper. I mean, it was like a Lakers Hall of Fame. So we got into this because my kids wanted to participate. I never knew that this giant world existed. And just trust me, many of you who kids are in some AAU sport right now, let me tell you something. I know how much that cost. I remember going, oh, this is where all our money is going. You know, this is where for the shoes, the jerseys, the coaching, all the side hustles to make my kid the very best he can possibly be. God bless Chase Liefeld, who as a freshman said, I don't have what it takes to be a pro. I'm going to finish out and I'm going to go into acting. Okay, then. This kid who was handpicked by the Compton Magic, my son, I've said it before, I'm so proud of him. He played a season and a half for the Compton Magic. The guy who owns the Compton Magic is the guy who owns the American Idol franchise. And he hand-selected, and that was the time when they said, no, you don't understand. You don't pay anything into this system. We provide everything, the shoes, what? It's like reverse. But Chase had his tryout at a hangar across the street from LAX and was just crazy impressive. And as an eighth grader, was invited to join the Compton Magic travel team. And again, all of the different crazy places that my kids brought us to, the one that we went to most frequently that was the most fun, because of course it's the strip, it's the shopping, it's the meals, it's everything was Las Vegas. It was a Monday morning after a huge weekend of competition that we were driving back as a family, and my phone rang, and it was Axel Alonso, the editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics. And he said, hey Rob, I got two words for you. Lady Deadpool. What do you think? And I said, I'm in. Let's go. Let's do it. He's like, all right, when can you send me some stuff? I said, I'll have sketches, I'll have doodles, I'll have everything your way by this afternoon. We pulled in around 2 p.m., and I had stuff to Axel later that evening, and we started building out Lady Deadpool. And I was in Maui with my family just a few months later because I illustrated the first introduced and provided input, story, and illustrations, because I penciled and inked the first appearances of Lady Deadpool. I am at a restaurant with my family in Maui. Phone rings again. It's Axel Alonso. Rob, I got two words for you. Deadpool Corps. That's where we're going with this stuff. The Deadpool Corps. What do you say? What do you say? What do you think? And we kibitz. We went back and forth. Dog pool. Okay. And okay, kid pool. Hey, they already had a head pool. So now we're building out the Deadpool Corps. So you're like, Liefeld, you're part of this. Hey, if you can't beat them, what's that famous moniker? If you cannot beat them, you join them. And so we were in the derivative Deadpool business, okay? But we are so far from sniffing the sheer volume of the Spider-Man derivatives. I'm not sure we could ever get there even if we tried, but the bottom line is, come on, you knew I was going to get to Red Hulk. Hey, we've had Gray Hulk, we've had Green Hulk, let's go lean all the way into Red Hulk, 2006. I mean, again, this derivative thing is working. It is working for Marvel more than it's working for anybody else. And they are leaning all the way into it. Now, here is the upside of the business part of that. You aren't paying anybody on those derivatives because they are, wait, derivatives, okay? The rare bird that gets a small piece of a derivative had to do some great work on doing that. But for the most part, because here's the deal. You may read about payouts to certain families and estates over the time by these big two companies, but you know, the Jim Shooter, when he established the royalty compensation system in late 81, early 82, that, you know, Wolverine was prior to that, Elektra was prior to that, Ghost Rider was prior to that, Blade the Vampire Hunter prior to that. Okay, so it was hard to get your foot in on these other characters because they, Marvel and DC and any other company operating during that time under those same auspices were like, that's work for hire. We weren't part of the character equity program yet. It was the character equity program, and learning from, honestly, the guy that boasted about it the most at every show he went to was Mr. Chris Claremont. Thank you, Chris, for speaking out loud about this stuff and educating fans like me who stood at the end of your table and just gobbled all that info up. That I was like, hey, how about in my first issue of New Mutants, how about I introduce, let's see, like 13 characters? How about 13? Is 13 good? If you go back and look, what's the biggest shift in New Mutants 87? It's not just Cable. It's the entire MLF. Strife and all his buddies and all those characters that I introduced, I signed deals on. Okay. When you're doing a gray Spider-Man, yellow Spider-Man, okay, that's just a derivative of the original works by Stan and Steve Ditko that were not originally available for a character royalty program. Similarly, the Hulk, Captain America, Thor, all of these. So there's a business allure to it. They exist already. That there is a maybe now and they're most generous because I don't know. So I'm just kind of grasping up here. But from what I hear, I love this word. This word does not get enough run. It was a word I heard a lot more of in the 80s. Scuttlebutt. The scuttlebutt of the day. The chatter. The what's going around. What you hear is those derivatives aren't terribly, they don't have a lot of participants, if any. So all the colors of the rainbow can be attributed to Hulk. Hey, on my disc right here is a purple Deadpool. Okay. There's also a blue, a yellow, a green, and a white Deadpool. Okay. The different colors have struck me personally, but with these original Marvel characters, if you're making a girl thing, if it's the thing and now his girlfriend's got the same cosmic ray, it just happens. One of the places that they also kind of we workshopped all this was in the What Ifs. When did Thor become a girl and have a hammer? In What If? Okay. Jane Foster picked up a hammer. I've covered that. It's called that those episodes called Marvel's Secret Playbook. Marvel did a series, blew up in the 70s, What If, different possibilities. You've encountered it as a show on Disney Plus. But trust me, the workshopping of those original issues were seen as outlandish scenarios of alternate storylines of characters that took paths and destinies that were generally much more consequential than what you got. Like if Rick Jones had been hit with the gamma rays instead of Bruce Banner. What if, Steve Rogers didn't, get exploded into the ocean and freeze, in the Arctic ice? All of these scenarios, almost every single damn one of them became a regular storyline. I did Wolverine, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., okay, about give or take 14 years before it became a dedicated canon story in the Wolverine comic book by Mark Miller. And I'm like, that's from our story. That's from the story Jim Valentino and I did. What If is such a rich, another rich playbook. But this playbook, the derivative playbook, has never been more lucrative than at this place and time. And again, well, Captain America's down and out. Get Bucky. Give him a gun. Give him a slick, kind of a silver-plated breastplate. Boom, you're off to the races. Hey, wait, Sam Wilson. He's Captain America now. The Captain America identity keeps put on characters, Sam Wilson and Rick Barnes, on these characters that predated, the character compensation initiative. So derivative, Hulk, Thor, Spider-Man, Iron Man, all of it. It is just, and then, I know it's a little different because one of the people over at DC routinely boasted about the different colors of the rainbow that they applied to different characters in the Green Lantern Corps. And I was able to use one of those arguments to win over the legal positioning that I am a participant in the earnings of all things Dove, since my Dove, Don Granger, has been around longer than the male Don Granger. It looks different, but based on if you're going to give money for the Blue Lantern, you are most certainly giving money to the female Dove. Derivatives is a big business, and yes, I just uncorked that my career started with a derivative, a female Dove. So guys, when I talk about derivatives, I know what I'm talking about. And think about it. Think about Red Hulk. Think about Gray Hulk. Think about Green Hulk. Think about how many people have taken up the mantle of Captain America. Female Thors, okay? Regular male Thor. Thor with a beard, okay? Frog Thor, the derivatives especially when it became okay to do them on TV and in the movies, it seems like the Marvel kind of film and television division went absolute bonkers drunk on, hey, let's give you every version of this character we possibly can because we can. Because now we can because the Spider-Verse did so well. They kicked down the door. They blew it open over there at Sony with Lord and Miller. And the licensing, the merchandising, the appetite for that stuff, I think, again, just like with the X-Men, you're like, what's going on here? Wait, every version of this Spider-Man derivative is now, you know, being hailed as a favorite. So again, guilty as charged. The Deadpool core, Lady Deadpool, Dogpool, Kidpool, you know, Female Dove. I know that which I speak. I've also introduced you to brand new worlds, Cable, Deadpool, the original character, Shatterstar, Domino, like, that wound down because I'm telling you, in the early 2000s, Marvel actively, the editorial and editors who were there, have confirmed to me that in the early 2000s, it was discouraged. They did not want your new characters. They would rather that you give them newfangled twists on existing Hulk, Iron Man, Captain America, Avengers characters. Again, Marvel was trying to build out their own studio. The rights to Spider-Man and X-Men were gone. Some of this is absolutely paramount in regards to the decisions that they made in wanting to build out. Again, the Avengers, they needed to zhuzh that up to Wall Street. How better to do it? Put Wolverine and Spider-Man on the team. So now you're kind of buying the X-Men, but it's called the Avengers. Now you're kind of buying Spider-Man, but it's called the Avengers. Doesn't matter. They're asking you to invest in the Avengers, and it doesn't matter who they put in the Avengers to get there. That's the bait. That's what they used. And so in the early 2000s, they are trying to zhuzh up more than ever. That's why the Ultimates line was so damn appealing. And that is why when you go and see the Avengers 2012 movie, it actually reflects more. I see more, especially when they're gathered and the way that Hawkeye and Captain America portrayed, they look like the Mark Miller, Brian Hitch versions, iterations of those characters more so than at any other time. And the bearded Thor from the Ultimates, again, first took flight with Walt Simonson in this 1987 initiative, this cover to Marvel Age 57 that showed you that the brave new world for these Marvel characters were new looks and new appearances, new costumes, and they all had storylines to go along with them. You know, at this point, it would actually probably be easier to list characters who don't have derivatives, especially in the Marvel stable, the characters that don't have derivatives. Good God, we've all seen a younger version of Cable, okay? We've seen, you know, other iterations of Black Panther. So I mean, again, it's easier now, I think, probably. I mean, Wolverine got daughters and sons, and there's claws all over, to the point of there is currently a book called Weapon X-Men, and they're all, wait for it, Wolverine derivatives. And I think that is the mic drop that we close this portion out. If you had any doubt that the playbook was established on that cover of Marvel 57, don't have zero doubts. That is where an entire initiative for an entire line, a marketing effort to turn your attention to some of these books that were selling in the middle numbers to get them sexed up, you know, make them new and sexy and appealing. This was the beginning of a playbook that after the chaos of the 90s, because the 90s was about the new Cable, Deadpool, Bishop, Domino, Shatterstar, Gambit, you name it. But again, by the middle, Punisher 2099, Spider-Man 2099. I mean, there's a Hulk 2099. He's featured in those books. I saw him, Hulk 2099. The initiative took flight. And then in the 2000s, when the chaos landed and they were coming up with their business plan, you better believe that the new Coke formula, you know, there's no reason that Coke didn't go back instead of just caving in and giving you classic again, Coke classic. And then, you know, the return was a big deal. You know, they could have gone back to the drawing board and zhuzhed it up. Maybe that's where cherry Coke comes from. Maybe that's where some of these other different flavors, like, well, they're going to reject any tampering with the classic formula, but we're just going to give them all matter. Hey, I am guilty. Do not hesitate for 1 minute to know that my favorite candy is a derivative of the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup. It is the Big Cup. My favorite drink is a derivative of Mountain Dew. It is Baja Mofo Blast. Baja Blast, okay? We are living in the derivative. I did a head spin the other day next to the big cups with the caramel in it. Now your Hershey bar has something in it. The candy bars, I mean, they are just going to squirt whatever they possibly can into our candy and double us up and make us that much bigger and make those dental bills even more formidable. That's it. But our drinks are in derivatives. You know, you can get a taco at Taco Bell that's wrapped in the gordita taco. I mean, you can get a pizza and a chicken. Is it called a chizza? I mean, you guys, what we have, our entire world is a world of derivatives. And am I going to lay blame on Marvel 57? I'm going to try as much as I possibly can with tongue firmly in cheek to convince you. No, it's just, like I said, you go back to Captain Marvel, Mary Marvel, the Shazam family in and of itself, Superboy, Supergirl, it's all there. But there's always something out there floating, and then the machine activates, and just like that scene from Frankenstein when it's alive, the electricity is crackling, the bodies are rising off the slabs, and that is what occurred, and that is our first of our eight 80s events that shaped the 2000s. The playbook was formed, and it was hot and ready to go, and the music of Cyndi Lauper and Billy Idol and Big Country and Duran Duran and Madonna and Michael Jackson and Prince were playing while all of these things were going on. Just settle you in to, you know, give you a soundtrack of when this was going down. And it was fun. And you know what? Let me tell you something. As much as I can tell you that the magic of the 80s, the 80s was when the magic of comic books was starting to slip away from me, that's not to say that these books weren't selling some of their best sales during that time, okay? Some of the X-Men books that I like the least were climbing in sales because X-Men was the flavor of the day on all of those spinoffs. And some of the most, you could convince me that some of the most mediocre issues of the Avengers creatively were bestsellers, better than the stuff that I hold dear, drawn by Jim Starlin and George Perez and John Byrne. You know, certainly the classics by Byrne and Austin with Chris Claremont got outsold later because the market expanded. But the reason the market expanded was because the fever that was created by these original initiatives. And again, let me go back to, sometimes fresh is better. Giant Size X-Men gave you a brand new Russian mutant, a brand new African-American, quote-unquote, goddess as this mutant named Storm. You got implementation of the character that we met, the Canadian brawler that was Wolverine, that was introduced and attached to Giant Size X-Men number 1. You got the German teleporter who looked like a demon, Nightcrawler. I mean, sometimes fresh can have its day. And I would say that fresh can get you even more mileage, but we live in an age of derivative, and it started in the manner with which it would go on to be exploited. This was that period, the 80s, the eight 80s events that informed, that shaped the 2000s, were just getting started. Looking back on all things 80s, I am reminded I was 12 years old in the 80s, in 1980, turned 13 in October of 1980, and then graduated when I was 17 from high school in 1985, and then turned 18 in the fall. So, crazy, crazy great times. Spent most of my formative teenagers, but years, you know, in the 80s. By the time 1980 hit, the incredible run of the Avengers that was written by Jim Shooter, drawn by George Perez, John Byrne, written by David Michelinie, the great Marvel 2-in-1, where Byrne and Perez also shared a lot of different artistic chores, and then the entirety of John Byrne's seminal, along with Terry Austin, Chris Claremont, X-Men run, that is still being, that is still influencing the comics that you're seeing today, all these years later. That was coming to an end. The Byrne run was coming to an end. It would end effectively in December 1980. So the 80s to me, I just so much great material. So much of it by two guys. I did a podcast. I think it's the number one. I'm at the number two or number three episode that I ever did. If you go all the way back to the beginning of all my episodes, called A Rivalry That Defined an Era. And it was John Byrne and George Perez. And they were, you know, make them Magic Johnson and Larry Bird of comic books. They were both battling to be the most prominent, most dominant, most influential, most popular creators, artists in the field, and the yin and yang between them. They both shared duties on the Fantastic Four. They both shared duties on the Avengers, on Marvel 2-in-1. John did the X-Men. George did an incredible annual that Chris Claremont praised as he talked of it like he regretted that was the only time that he would work with George Perez. The two of them just tremendously defined an era. And as the 80s kicked off, John was not on the X-Men anymore. George Perez had crossed the street and gone to DC Comics. I go into a lot of this down in some of the earlier episodes that I'm mentioning here. Much more to come in regards to all things 80s as we intermittently drop these 8 80s events that inform the 2000s. So hang on. Hey, in the meantime, we are all over social media. I am on Twitter at Robert Liefeld. RobertLiefeld. That's my name on Twitter/X. I love reading your replies, your mentions, all the ways that we interact and have so many different discussions. I have gotten to know so many of your handles and so many of all of you through Twitter, which was really the birth of my most interactive phase on social media. From there, I jumped to Instagram. Follow me on Instagram at Rob Liefeld. Both Robert Liefeld on X and Rob Liefeld on Instagram have blue checks certifying that I am the real deal, the certified person that you were talking to, not an imposter. There are plenty of imposter accounts out there, and they've done a pretty good job cleaning up a lot of them. So as to curtail a lot of the confusion that's out there. But I am on Instagram at Rob Liefeld, on Twitter/X as at Robert Liefeld. Both of them enjoy all the interaction, all of the back and forth, the replies, the mentions, the DMs. Instagram is more of a visual kind of diary of my life and my work, and I try and share all of that as much as possible and include you, and I just enjoy, I love it. I love the interaction. I love talking to people all around the world. It is absolute the bonus of social media, and I try and take advantage of it as much as possible. Where Facebook is concerned, we have a great group. It's a group on Facebook called Rob Liefeld Marvel Extreme and Beyond. I would love for you to join us. Many of the topics that we discuss here, we go deeper and more in depth over in that group. We have a great, positive, comic book loving vibe over there. No negative stuff is allowed. We are really good at moderating and administrating. I have a gentleman over there named Terry Sala, S-A-L-A. He is my co-admin, co-moderator of the boards, and he may be one of the guys that clicks you on through to the other side when you contact us. And we are just having the best time. We have art contests there. Terry runs those. We vote on them in regards to how everyone's different art places and who wins, and then the winner gets to choose the next topic, the next subject in the catalog. It's a great place, great vibes, great people. I invite you to come over there to the Rob Liefeld Marvel Extreme and Beyond group and hang out with us, and we look forward to seeing you there. I am on a live stream called Whatnot. The app Whatnot needs to be downloaded, and then you need to follow me, Rob Liefeld, on the app. When you're not looking into my store, which I'm generally live in the middle of the week, Wednesdays, and then on a Friday or Saturday weekend, we go live. But when you're not there with me, there are so many other kick-ass stores. They're selling Silver Age, Bronze Age, Modern Age comic books, toys, Funko Pops, sports jerseys, kicks, trading cards, playing cards. They have extensive jewelry, women's clothing. I mean, it is a giant app that is state-of-the-art. This platform sings. It is a great interaction. On my show, if you follow Rob Liefeld, you'll get notified when I am going to go on one of my live streams. We have tons of exclusives that we've done over the last couple of years. Deadpool, whatnot exclusives that are available only through the live stream. Spider-Man, New Mutants, X-Force, Prophet, Evangeline. I have a brand new book called The Last Blood. I wrote it. I drew it. It's 28 pages long. It's brand new. It concerns the fate of many of my extreme characters. I invite you to come on board and check out all of the different exclusives. I do remarks on Funko Pops, on toys. There is a great amount of original art, affordable original art. I try and make art that is more affordable to you, the fan, than some of the really more expensive high-end pieces. This is more like a starter kit, prelims, sketches, all of that stuff that we offer there. It's so fun. I love hanging out with you. When I am on the live stream, it is right on me. The camera's on me. I am talking to you the entirety of the show. The other night, we did a three-hour show. There was so much going on. We had to keep it going. We love seeing you over on Whatnot. Get the app, download it, and then follow me, Rob Liefeld, over there, and you will be alerted as to my next shows. We have extended the deadline for my CGC in-house signing. CGC, the premier grading company, which gives you all the very best slabs. I am doing my very second signing with them. It took me several years to even get on the boards with them and get the first one scheduled, and we did it last fall, and it went fantastic. You got high grades. You got them turned around quickly. There was all sorts of different options on the menu. Those still exist, although some of them have sold out. I'm not up to date as to what is left, but you should go to the CGC website, look up Rob Liefeld, see what menu items are available. All the basic just signature options are still there. Please get your books in before the deadline closes in May, and we can get you your. The idea is to do the signing in June so that you can get your books by the end of July. The last weekend of July is when Deadpool Wolverine is opening, and you have told us that that is when you want those books to, you want them in your hands, and we want to get them in your hands. But first, you've got to send them into CGC and arrange for me to sign them in person when I travel again, once again to Florida, and do our very second signing. We did thousands of your submissions over a number of days last fall. So I am so excited to be doing this one more time. CGC, Rob Liefeld, private in-house signing. Check it out and get your books in as soon as you possibly can. At the very end of each and every episode, we read the reviews that you're leaving for us. Sometimes, many times, they're on the Apple platform. That is really what is the most beneficial to us, which helps our platform stand out, elevates us, gives us a better profile. Thank you so much for taking the time out to write these. Today, this is from a gentleman named Gord Berry. Gord Berry was very generous, and he contacted us to say, Rob, he gives us high marks, 5 stars, just listening to your latest podcast, The 9 Controversies, or if we were British, The 9 Controversies from the 90s. Man, when you talked about the shops and retailers having so much product just sitting there, you nailed it. Those were gross, dark times for those of us who had been collecting as fans. All I saw out at the stores were D-bags buying 50 copies of Superman 82. Been back into collecting for about 5 years now and have met some really awesome people and found that everyone collects in their own way. Glad to see that you are still a positive force in the industry, Rob. Gord, thank you for this. Thank you so much for taking the time to share this and send this my way. And yeah, the 90s was crazy. That three-part series on the 90s went way longer than I anticipated, but there was just so much to discuss. Again, as I said earlier in this episode, it was the 90s was glorious chaos. So much of it worked out, some of it didn't, but there were so many new companies coming into the scene, and it just caused confusion, and there was tremendous debt and all of that. But thank you for listening and writing into us, taking time to write into the show and tell me what you're digging. I appreciate it so much. I appreciate all of you, the way that you pass along this show. You tell people the word of mouth, and you guys have verified. You have told me how much the show has shared with you, maybe some stuff that you didn't know, pieces of comic book history, events, personalities, behind the scenes shenanigans. And look, we have been, we are well past 350 episodes now. We passed that a while back, and we are just continuing to move forward, continuing to plant these episodes for you and vet them as best we possibly can, just like today's beginning of our 880s events that shaped the 2000s. Thank you for listening. I hope you continue to listen, continue to spread the word, continue to listen on your commutes, while you're jogging, working out at the gym, when you're working, when you're drawing, however that you are interacting with us. I thank you and appreciate you so much. The very tail end is when I got to reach out and tell you, I'm rooting for you. I am hoping that your physical, your spiritual, your emotional, and your mental state are in the very best possible state. It can be absolutely overwhelming out there. There is so much going on, families, business, just all manner of burdens and stress that we deal with on a daily basis as parents, as brothers, as uncles, grandfathers, whatever hat that you are wearing, husbands, sons, whatever way that you are interacting. I am just fist bumping you right through this blue Yeti mic and telling you, take permission to step away from the grind. Take a day, enjoy a great book, a great graphic novel, a streaming show, a movie that you haven't gotten out and experienced yet. Go out to dinner with loved ones, with friends, with family. Have great meals, great food. Enjoy just that great interaction that can happen over a great meal or a great movie or a great social outing, a great double date, triple date, social, whatever you're doing. You know that I value, above all else, desserts, okay? Milkshakes, cupcakes, just cake. And of course, candy bars. Good God, they're getting so advanced with these candy bars. But the Reese's Big Cup is my key to happiness. 90 seconds every day. It is so delicious. They are so mouth-watering, amazing. That is my sugar buzz mid-morning. Oh, just gets me to that next level. That's what I'm talking about. And look, I practice what I preach during the weekends, during the week. I get away my recliner chair, my sofa, my bean bag. I get away. I catch up. I revisit some comic books that really give me the juice. I recently was diving back into so much of Jack Kirby's seminal work, and it's inspiring to me. Or I'm going to go out. Joy and I went out for a great date night Friday night. Just laughed, had the best food, tried a new restaurant, just a great time, and came back just so reinvigorated. And it was great because I was working on Saturday, and Joy had things to do. So Saturday, man, I had filled up my cup and I was able to pour it out onto the page. And before I even went live on Whatnot that night, I scanned and sent a page that I had penciled in ink that morning all throughout the day. Locked it in at 5 o'clock, sent it to my guy who's coloring it, and went on and did a Whatnot show, and it was just great. But it was all that extra time and planning to have that great time with Joy that I had on Friday night. That's what I'm talking about. Rooting for you always, hoping that you are finding that time to get off the grind, take time for yourself, and get yourself right, and get yourself happy, and get inspired. Hey, boom, bumping you once again, wishing you all the best, and thank you for listening. Please do not leave me stranded here. You've got to come back, because we most definitely, we absolutely, and more importantly, always, inevitably, we're going to talk again real soon.